So before we get to part B, oh yes, first a question.
Just when we're making like corrections, are you serious about putting like initials, date, circle?
Oh, question was asked, if you have to make a change in the lab book, how do we need to do it? Do we need to do it the way that you're talking about in the syllabus? And eventually, yeah, that would be the best approach. Maxwell, right?
Yeah.
What he's getting at is you just got an instruction to change the quantities for Part B to half what they're supposed to be. The best way to show that in a lab book is just to put one line through whatever quantity it was so you could still read what you had originally, write the correction next to it. At a minimum, that's what you should do. Because in the future, let's say you figured out, no, you really had the right quantity written down the first time. Then you could still see that original quantity. In real life, mistakes are perfectly fine to make, but you document, again, so you can have a trail of what your thought process was, so that if you end up in a situation like I might have described, where if you're in a patent case, they're going to go back to your lab books, and they're going to see the work that you did. And when they see corrections, it doesn't mean that you're falsifying something. They just know that you did a thorough job keeping up your lab book. Lab books technically should never be written in pencil or anything erasable. Everything's supposed to be a permanent record. So yes, properly, you're supposed to just put a single line through it, write the new quantity. Some places make you then initial the page to show that you really did make that change and to hold you legally accountable if you were lying about the fact that you made the change. So we need to talk about Part B, but we need to talk about the end of Part A. Because at the end of lab last time, most likely all that you had was the aqueous solution and then the organic solution. And so you need to do something with both of those. What are you doing with the aqueous solution? Yes? And why are you adding HCl? To protonate the benzoate, which makes it nonpolar again. So the whole point of this extraction is we started out with benzoic acid that was nonpolar and naphthalene that was nonpolar. The two of them both dissolved in the same solvent, so we wanted some trick to be able to separate them apart. And what we did is we reacted with sodium hydroxide, which will react with the benzoic acid, but not with the naphthalene. So benzoic acid becomes far more polar when it becomes benzoate, and so that's why it's able to slip into the aqueous layer. And so I think we even wrote the neutralization reaction down last time. Well, we take that benzoate, reacidify it, turns back into benzoic acid, and drops out as a precipitate. So for the aqueous layer, which is the sodium hydroxide layer, and this is for Part A that we're talking about, you're going to acidify it until a precipitate forms. Now I'm trying to figure out the best way to phrase what I need to express next, which is not that I don't want to answer your questions. Don't get that impression. But I don't want to answer this kind of question. Is this acidic enough? Because I'm not pH paper. I'm not a spectrometer. I'm going to look at that solution and have no more idea looking at it than you are. But what ends up happening is because some of you are very eager, but maybe don't have confidence in lab yet. So even if you've done what the procedure says for you to do, you're still coming to me to say, this is what I did, and did I do it right? Which if you've followed the procedure and you did the test that tells you to do, it's going to be right. Or even if it's not, I won't be able to tell because I'm not a piece of analytic equipment. Same issue comes up in just a moment when we talk about drying agents, when we're dealing with the neutral layer, the organic layer. Every year I get person after person after person ask me, is this enough drying agent? Is this enough drying agent? Even though I explain how to tell if there's enough drying agent. So if you need your hand held, in other words, just to say, you know, you're doing a good job in lab, don't ask me those questions because you do need to be a little bit more independent. So how do you know that there's enough acid in there? Well, two things are going to happen. You're going to make the precipitate. If you don't make a precipitate, that means you probably need to add more acid. How much acid are you going to need? Well, you know the strength of the sodium hydroxide you used, 3 molar, 2.5, 3 molar. You can estimate the volume that you use, and you know how many moles of sodium hydroxide. So as people have passed Chem 1A, that means you should be able to calculate how many milliliters of the hydrochloric acid you would need. So don't ask me how much, you calculate it. Then how can you check that you have added enough besides the fact that there's a precipitate that should form? Well, what does it suggest that you do?
Check with pH paper.
Check with pH paper. So if your pH paper turns bright pink, you know it's acidic, and you know you've added enough acid. Because it won't turn pink until you've added enough acid that anything there you were neutralizing has been neutralized. Now, just a reminder, please, I only found one piece of pH paper that was left around somewhere. So that was a pretty good job this morning. Don't leave those little pieces of pH paper everywhere. Now, once you get the solid, how do you manipulate it? Because one of the experiences that you're going to have in this lab is the joy of working with solid products. Joy meaning that's not really joy. It's a pain because in this case, for the aqueous layer, the benzoic acid's not soluble in water. So at least it won't cake on most likely to the sides of your flasks. But the organic layer, when we get to discussing it, it's going to stick like crazy probably to your glassware. And so you're going to have difficulty isolating your solid materials, and that's a real-life problem. We don't have magical solutions for that problem, although over time, we'll learn techniques to deal with that issue. So, benzoic acid is not very soluble in water, and the colder the water you get, the less soluble it is. So if you have added hydrochloric acid in, you've got your precipitate, and you need to filter, which... How many people in here have not used a Hirsch funnel before? Okay, a couple of people. Let's just remind ourselves how a Hirsch funnel works then. You're going to have your vacuum flask, which is the Erlenmeyer that's got the sidearm to it. That sidearm you're going to attach to the vacuum system. You'll have your Hirsch funnel... That will be the funnel plus that black rubber adapter. So the adapter fits in between the two so that the adapter forms a seal between the Hirsch funnel and the filter flask, or the vacuum flask. The Hirsch funnel itself has got holes in the top of it. And that's so that a liquid can come through. On top of that, you should put a piece of filter paper. Which the small pieces of filter paper are located in the little tool kit that's on top of the refrigerator over there. So, piece of filter paper on top of the Hirsch funnel, which is on the adapter, which seals it to the vacuum flask. Turn the vacuum on, it's going to pull suction through the funnel. You're going to pour the entire contents of your container, the solid, the liquid, all of it, onto the top of that Hirsch funnel. The liquid will pass through, the solid will be caught by the filter paper, and that's what you want, is that solid. You don't want the liquid that comes through.
You're going to want to weigh the filter paper?
Ah, good point. And I was going to make this point when we get to the neutral compound especially, that these flasks that you're collecting the compounds in, what if it's next to impossible for you to scrape all that compound out? Well, one of the things that I do want you to do is make sure you're getting accurate measurements of mass for everything that you're recovering. So, just like Max suggested, if your solid is all going to end up on the filter paper, then maybe it would be best to get the mass of that filter paper ahead of time. So that once everything's dried out, even if you can't get it scraped off the filter paper, then you can do a mass determination by difference. Same thing when we're going to evaporate the organic compound. When you get rid of the ether layer, the compound's going to be pretty much stuck to your glassware. So before you begin, you might want to get a teared mass of that flask. so that you don't have to spend all that time scraping it out. You just get the mass difference, and that tells you how much product you really ended up with. So yes, I might recommend that you measure the mass of that weighing paper first, or the filter paper. But you pour the entire contents onto the funnel, it'll drip through. Then what if not all the solid got transferred? Well, then you get a spatula out and you spend forever trying to scrape the solid out. Or you can wash with just a little bit of ice cold water. Now, ether absolutely won't do the job, because remember, at this point you're trying to recover that solid. Ether is going to dissolve it, not recover it. It'll just be dissolved. So you need to use water, what it's not soluble in, to try to just physically dislodge it. But it needs to be ice cold water, which means get ice if you need to. Which, to get ice, if you bring the buckets over here, they're labeled ice container or something like that, bring that to the stock room, they'll fill it up with ice for you. Get a little beaker of your own, fill it with water, put it in the ice bath. It'll cool the water down. Use that to wash out your crystals. That just reduces how much loss that's going to occur. So, in fact, I'll make this a written note. Benzoic acid can be washed with small quantities of ice-cold water. Benzoic acid has lower solubility in cold water. But not zero solubility. So you use ice cold water to reduce that solubility, and you use as little water as you can to avoid dissolving any. Use too much water, and the little itty bitty bit of solvent that, or solid that you're trying to transfer over, you may dissolve the equivalent of that amount in just playing with the sample than if you just forgotten it in the first place. But because this is your first experiment, do make the effort to recover as much solid as possible. Recrystallization, skip for now, because you're going to recover benzoic acid in part A, part B, part C, and we're going to combine those to make a larger, easier to handle sample of benzoic acid for you to recrystallize. So skip recrystallization for the moment. So once you have transferred all of the crystals over, it might tell you to wash with a little cold water, which means just sprinkle ice cold water on what you've collected, and again to try to filter through. That'll pull some of the water soluble impurities through. And then take that, put it on a watch glass, and leave it between now and Wednesday. Don't even take the mass today, because you want to make sure all that water's gone. Because it's a solid, you don't have to put it into a sealed container. It might say something about putting a filter paper or something on top. Technically, you don't even need to bother with that. But anything you do store in your drawers, remember that you have to label. So you can store the solid in a watch glass, but make sure you've labeled the watch glass with benzoic acid. So questions what to do with the sodium hydroxide layer. Yes? That part you don't have to do.
Right.
You don't need to cover because we want the water to disappear. The reason it recommends that is so if you have a powder and you're walking around and someone sneezes, you don't blow your powder away. Other questions about the aqueous layer? Then let's talk about what to do with the organic layer. So we had the aqueous layer that had the benzoate because it reacted with the sodium hydroxide. We had naphthalene that was left behind that didn't react because it wasn't acidic. And so we need to remove the organic layer, but before we do that, we need to use a drying agent. Which is often a dehydrated hydrate. So something that is a desiccant. A desiccant is a fancy word for a drying agent. Magnesium sulfate, calcium sulfate, zinc sulfate. All three are often used as drying agents. They might be a fine powder. They might be a little bit more larger granule material, but usually some kind of powder form. The purpose of a drying agent is not to get rid of liquid. Dry doesn't mean liquidless, it means waterless. So the drying agent's only purpose is to get rid of water that might still be stuck in your organic layer. So, the magic questions. How do I know how much to add? How do I know when it's done drying? Neither of those questions I can answer because I'm not the one doing the experiment. Here's how you can tell if you've added enough, though. You add some drying agent, which it says, I believe, a spatula tip full is its recommendation. And that means whatever the tip of your spatula is, fill it up and dump that much in. Swirl it around for a few minutes. Probably recommends 5-10 minutes, something like that. If you only put a little bit of drying agent in and there's a lot of water around, it's going to clump up. It's going to make these larger clumps of material. And there won't be any of that fine powdery drying agent left. So you know it's working if it clumps. If you add in some and no clumping occurs, it might mean that you didn't have much water to begin with either. But if clumping occurs, you know it's removing water. How do you know if it's been sitting around long enough? Well, if you can find any drying agent that's still in powdery form, that hasn't clumped up, then that means that there was more drying agent there than the amount of water you needed to remove, which that means it did its job. If you end up with just clumps, you can't tell if it's done or not. You have to add more drying agent and see if it remains granular or see if that clumps together. So, when you add the drying agent, you'll see clumps form, most likely. If after that clump is formed, you still have leftover granular drying agent, then the drying agent did its job. Does that make sense the way I've described it? So you've got to add some, see if it clumps together. If it did, it's working. But then you've got to see if there's more left, more of it powdery left. And if not, then you need to add more drying agent. Over time, we'll learn some other ways of telling. But that's the first one. That's the one that will work for today. Usually, a drying agent will clump together in the presence of water. If, after drying has occurred, if there is still powderized drying agent, and that's in addition to the clumped material, enough drying agent was added. Now, some of you, if you did the separation really well, you might never see clumped material, which just means you didn't have much water and you'll never see the clumping. So really the same thing applies in that case. If you wait some time and you've just got powdery dry agent, well, that's not a bad situation either. It means it was dry to begin with. Now, what do you do from that point? Well, it mentions gravity filtration, does it not? Yeah. Gravity filtration, what we'll do is use glass funnels, which some of you already had these in your toolkit. I don't have one out to show you, but when you think of a funnel, exactly that, just a simple glass funnel. Those of you who had it in your kit already, just keep the one you got. Those of you who didn't have it, you need to check one out from the stock room. And then you'll use a piece of filter paper in it. The simplest way to fold it is to do the following. Fold it in half. Fold it again in half to make quarters. And three of the four of the quarters keep clumped together. Just one of the four pull out. And then that's made a little paper funnel. The paper funnels you can just dispose of in the waste. It is perfectly fine to put solid waste in something that's labeled for liquid. That's not a problem. If we have something that's labeled solid, you shouldn't put liquid in it. Anything that's liquid needs to be labeled liquid, no matter how little liquid there is. But it's fine to take these, once they're done, and toss them into the waste buckets, which, given how little of anything that's going to be stuck on here, whether it's the acidic or basic waste, doesn't particularly matter in this case. Paper, for all purposes, you could say, is neutral. When you pour the drying agent and the solution through, the drying agent will be caught in the paper, which is what you want, and only the liquid's going to come through. You might want to take a little bit more ether, wash the beaker that whole sample just came from, because as you're going to discover, as soon as that ether evaporates, a residue is left behind. So to make sure you recover as much of your product as possible, again, you might want to rinse out that beaker and also pour that through. And that will be what you evaporate off in your fumaroles. How are you going to do the evaporation? Well, there's two choices, and it depends on which solvent. Ether has a very, very, very low boiling point, 34.5 degrees Celsius, which means lower than body temperature. So you only need to very gently heat ether in order for it to evaporate. Another temperature we should care about is its auto-ignition point, which means get it this hot and it bursts into flames all by itself. If you were really paying attention, if I mentioned it in this section on the first day, the two fires that have occurred in chemistry labs that I've had since being at De Anza were both ether-related, and they were both because students were impatient and turned their hot plates all the way up, and the stuff auto-ignited. It got hot enough where it just caught on fire. So if you're going to evaporate ether, you've got to keep your temperature below, well, comfortably below, 100 to 60 degrees Celsius. Now, your two choices for evaporation. One, you can have an Erlenmeyer or something where you have your stir bar. Then below that, you'll have a stirring hot plate, which, if you're not familiar how those work, well, first let me point out, each one of you should have a hot plate in your fume hoods, either in the fume hood itself or in one of the cabinets below the fume hoods. Each one's got a label on it saying which fume hood it should be in. So if you get to your fume hood and you don't have two of them, that means someone next to you took one, and you should go hunt it down and reclaim it for your own.
The way these things work is they've got a heating element in them, but they also have a magnet, a large magnet, which turns. If you put a little stir bar magnet inside of your beaker then, your Erlenmeyer, then as the large magnet of the hot plate turns, it will force the magnet inside the container to turn as well, which means you can sit there and get nice consistent stirring without you ever having to do the stirring. You just sit it and let it go. So you get a stirring solution of ether and heat it gently. Again, keeping it way below the 160 degree mark. Now for other solvents that are a bit more recalcitrant, a bit trickier to evaporate, instead of doing it at atmospheric pressure with just an open container, we might instead do it under vacuum. Because you might remember that boiling point is the point where vapor pressure equals surrounding atmospheric pressure. If you change surrounding atmospheric pressure, it doesn't change the vapor pressure. It just changes the boiling point. So if we put something under vacuum, the boiling point drops because evaporation is still occurring at the same rate. So what you could do is use your pear-shaped flask. When you're using the pear-shaped flask, because it comes down to a point, it would be better to use your spin vane, something that's more compatible shape-wise with that. Attached to that, the flow control adapter. And then attach that to the vacuum. So what you're doing is using the vacuum to pull all your solvent off. The reason you don't want to just hook it straight up to vacuum, no control. If all of a sudden you establish vacuum, because it's such a, in ether's case, because it's such a low boiling point material, when you put it under vacuum, it may all suddenly bump. It may all get sucked in all at once. So you have this control knob, so you can controllably introduce vacuum to the system or shut it back off if you need to. So with ether at room temperature, you could just sit there with it spinning under vacuum and it will evaporate that way as well. You also could use a combination of the two. If you really wanted to hurry it along, heat it a little bit and then have it stirring at the same time. Now, I didn't mention this to the morning section. This is my own reminder to myself, but they didn't get far enough that I had to worry. But if you are going to heat today, I really recommend indirect heating, which means you're going to use a sand bath. So these very fancy cat food containers that are sitting in your fume hoods, just put this on top of your stir plate. Settle the beaker inside of here, or your pear-shaped flask. The more you bury it, the more heat contact that you're going to get, but the heat is more diffuse, more spread out, than just by contacting that hot bit of hot plate. So I might recommend that you use a sand bath as well, yes.
Wouldn't that stop the stir bar from working?
No, if you get it settled back, if you get it settled far enough down, there's the magnet in the stir plate is generally strong enough, it'll get that magnet to spin anyways. Now, it can have issues. You do have to sometimes play with it a little bit, but they're usually good enough that it'll push through, you could say. So, once you evaporate your organic layer, don't do any recrystallizations, don't do any melting points today. All of that's going to be saved for the end of the lab, and I didn't mark it up above, but I'm going to recommend I'm going to recommend that you use a teared flask. That way, once your stuff is stuck on there, instead of spending half an hour scraping it out, if all I care about is the mass that you've obtained, then you can get that mass by difference. Questions with anything related to part A of the experiment? Yes?
That was just a different way.
These are two different ways. Ether evaporates at such a low boiling point that method one would be perfectly fine. And then, yes, let me put the two there to show that vacuum, it's not really distillation, vacuum solvent removal is another viable option. And do the two together, heating while under vacuum, best possible scenario. The only thing, please make sure that you don't heat it up anytime that it's not an open system. Vacuum, because it's a mechanical device constantly pulling air in, well, you can count that as an open system. But if you were to heat something that was closed, well, pressure builds up and nice miniature glass explosion in lab. We prefer not to have that. Question about part A. Then for what time you have today to do it, get as far into procedure B as you can. Let's go over the logic of part B. In part B, you still have two of the same starting compounds, don't you? Benzoic acid and naphthalene. What else do you have now, though?
Two naphthol.
Two naphthol.
The two comes from the way that nomenclature of these ringed systems is handled. And for now, I'll just tell you that numbering begins towards the inside of the compound. Don't even worry about memorizing these numbers yet. We won't see something like this again until 12B. But I'm just telling you where the 2 comes from, because you can see the 2 position, as the way I've numbered it, is where the OH group shows up. Now that all ending in the name, that is a designation that it is an alcohol. So when we have our lecture coming up soon on nomenclature, we're going to find that these different functional groups have name endings that we tack on to things. So naphthalene, we drop a chunk of that name, stick on this thing all, and that's what shows that it is an alcohol.
Then we still have naphthalene itself as one of the three compounds. Now very similarly to benzoic acid, naphthol is for the most part nonpolar, because yes, you've got this OH group, but the larger portion of the molecule, the naphthalene portion of the molecule, is symmetric and nonpolar. So if you were to take these three compounds and put them into an organic solvent, they're all three going to dissolve, and it would be very difficult, just on the basis of solubility tricks, to separate one from the other. But just like in part A, we're doing an acid-base experiment. Acid-base extraction, where we're purposefully changing the functional group, changing its polarity to make it go into the aqueous layer. Except we're using two different bases this time, aren't we? Well, we're using sodium hydroxide, but what's the other base? Sodium bicarbonate. Now let me write down the parent of sodium bicarbonate, carbonic acid. Which, for those of you who took Chem 50 or remember from being mentioned in Chem 1, what do you know about carbonic acid? Are we going to isolate that material somehow during our experiment? Because we'll form it,
If we're using bicarbonate as a base, we're going to make carbonic acid, but are we going to end up with any? The answer is no, because it's going to decompose into carbon dioxide and water. But if you take water, put it under pressure of carbon dioxide, that's how you make carbonated drinks. That's what carbonic acid is. So you don't form it as an isolatable compound.
But I'm putting this carbonic acid name down so I could tell you that it has a pKa of 6.9. And I'll also tell you that the pKa of naphthol is 9.51. And I'll remind ourselves that the other day we figured out the pKa of benzoic acid is 4.2. Why do we care about these numbers? Well, you have three compounds in one sample and you throw sodium bicarbonate at it as the first extraction. Well, let's see what would happen with these three different compounds. Naphthalene, I'll just tell you, nothing happens. Since I haven't even written a pKa value down, you can assume that it's non-acidic. Now remember that just saying non-acidic doesn't mean it's basic. It just means it's not acidic. But then we have these two other compounds where I could show benzoic acid. Reacting with sodium bicarbonate, which if that happens, the products we'll make are sodium benzoate, just like in the part A, plus before it decomposes for just a moment, we're going to have carbonic acid. We have pKa's of 4.2 and 6.9 respectively. So between these two acids, which one's the stronger one? Is benzoic acid or carbonic acid the stronger acid? Benzoic acid, which I know we haven't hit our review of acid-base chemistry yet. But if you are weak on what pKa values are or what they mean, you need to start reviewing now. Because one of the questions in your lab quiz is going to be very likely, why did you use bicarbonate as the first extract in this portion of the experiment? I'm answering that right now with what I'm showing you, but the answer involves pKa values. Since the pKa of benzoic acid is lower than carbonic acid, it is the stronger acid. And just as in our discussion of part A, when we figure out which is the stronger acid, that means its conjugate is going to be weaker. Because strong means it loves to lose its proton, so why would it want its proton back again? So the weaker base will be on the right. Carbonic acid being the weaker acid, that means it makes the stronger base, the stronger conjugate, which means this reaction's going to occur. This neutralization. Now let's throw the same equation up, though, using naphthol instead. So 2-naphthol reacting with bicarbonate, if it occurs, is going to form an anion. Which the name would technically be sodium 2-naphthoxide. And then again, if it happens, before it decomposes, we'd make carbonic acid.
But is this going to happen?
If I tell us that the pKa values are 9.51 versus 6.9. Well, which one of these two compounds is the weaker acid this time? The phenol, or not phenol, the naphthol. Naphthol is weaker because it's got the higher pKa. Higher pKa, lower Ka, lower amount of dissociation, weaker acid. Well, if it's a weak acid, weaker acid, that means it doesn't want to be a base. So the base would be stronger. Well, that means in this particular neutralization, it's not going to occur. Because you're trying to make the weak acid and weak base dissociate, which they don't want to make a stronger acid and stronger base, which in reality would react and go right back to where you started at. So you have three compounds in solution, but because we've carefully chosen the conjugate base of an acid that has a pKa in between the two compounds we want to target, we're able to target those two different compounds. So in a mixture of multiple acids with distinct pKa values, you can isolate one from the other by starting with a weak base and then increasing the base strength each time you do the next subsequent extraction. So in this part B, you start with the three compounds together. You have the naphthalene, you have the 2-naphthol, and you have the benzoic acid. You dissolve them up just like you did in this first experiment in diethyl ether. You then add to the separatory funnel, not sodium hydroxide first, but sodium bicarbonate, because since it's a weak base, it can't force a weak acid to react, but the stronger acid, benzoic acid, can react. And so what you end up with is two layers. Since ether is again the solvent that you're using, ether will again appear on top. So we'll have ether with the 2-naphthol and the naphthalene. The bottom layer will have water, plus you'll have benzoate. Benzoic acid could react. And so you targeted one compound and brought it out of the mixture. Just like in part A, you're going to separate out the water layer. And you'll re-acidify to cause a precipitate and then filter that out. But unlike part A, you're not going to drain the top layer. You're going to leave it in there and add your second solvent. You're going to do a back-to-back extraction. So you leave it in the separatory funnel, but you add sodium hydroxide now. Again, you're going to form two layers. Again, since it's still ether, the ether layer will be up top. But because sodium hydroxide is a gesundheit, a stronger base, now it will react with the naphthol. So all you're going to have is ether and naphthalene. The aqueous layer will now have the water plus naphthoxide. You'll separate that out, acidify and filter. And then the organic layer, that you'll take out and you'll dry and filter. So after the extractions, the procedures for part B are very similar to part A. Reacidification and filtering, or pulling off the ether as a solvent. The logic even is the same. Attack an acid with a base to change its polarity. The one extra concept in this is, what do you do if you've got multiple acids? How can you take advantage of the differing strengths of acids to extract out one and then another? Questions about part B. Now, if you didn't hear earlier, please do again use half quantities for part B, just like you did for part A. Get through as much of part B procedure-wise as you have time to today. You have 25 minutes before I'll give you your first time warning. You have 45 minutes till the end of class. Let's go ahead and get to work.